Hi, it's Patrick here. And sometimes I feel like a war correspondent, a linguistic war correspondent. Here I am, as you'll hear later in the pod, perched on the front lines of yet another language conflict. Which makes me think that we'll know when humanity's time is up, because people will have stopped arguing over language. Today, a debate in Britain about whether people applying for their version of green cards should be able to speak English.
Coming to Britain is a privilege, not a right, and it carries certain responsibilities. And one of those is to learn enough English to get by in the community, because it encourages integration rather than segregation.
But what if the visa applicant is elderly and he just wants to live with his wife? Well, if he does learn English, he better not use its swear words. He might be fined. Also, the Muslim world's answer to spelling bees, a contest where kids recite the Quran by heart.
As a free man, I take pride in the word, Ich bin ein Violiner.
Why, as an American, do I have to push a button to speak English?
I'm here with Patrick, and it's time to talk words. Rah. New words, old words, censoring everything.
This podcast, The World in Words, and the broadcast, The World Radio Program, The Big Show, they are both co-productions of the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH radio station here in Boston. Online, we're at theworld.org/language. You can also find my blog posts at patrickcox.wordpress.com. You can follow me on Twitter, where I tweet a whole bunch of language stories that I don't actually get to in this podcast. My handle is Patricox, P-A-T-R-I-C-O-X. And you can like a Facebook page called The World in Words. So today, a challenge to a new visa rule in Britain that requires proficiency in English. And then a town in Britain where, if you do speak English, keep it clean. You swear, you pay a fine. Then to Alaska, where a group of kids are learning the native tongue of their refugee parents. And finally, memorizing the Quran in its entirety. Okay, imagine, if you will, that you're married to, I don't know, a Chinese citizen. And you want to move to China to live with your spouse. But the government in China says no, because you don't speak Chinese. Well, that's strictly a hypothetical. China doesn't have a language requirement like that. And nor does the United States, for that matter. The only language test for immigrants coming to the U.S. is for citizenship, not for a green card, for any other kind of visa. But now, in Britain, they have introduced such a test for people applying for residency visas. And it's being challenged in court. Here's a report that I did for The Big Show this week. When Britain's Conservative-led government came to power last year, one key objective was to tighten immigration and reverse policies of so-called multiculturalism. Here's Prime Minister David Cameron.
Under the doctrine of state multiculturalism, we've encouraged different cultures to live separate lives apart from each other and apart from the mainstream. We failed to provide a vision of society to which they feel they want to belong. We've even tolerated these segregated communities behaving in ways that run completely counter to our values.
Cameron's government has made some changes to immigration law, among them a new language requirement. Anyone applying for a visa for long-term residency, roughly equivalent to a green card, will now be tested to make sure they have a basic grasp of English. As a result, Rashida Chapti, a naturalized British citizen, cannot get a visa for her husband, who, like her, was born in India.
My husband is 58 years old. He's too old to learn English. If he was young, he could have learned English. If he had come here earlier, he would have learned English. But now he's old.
Chapti is suing the British government on human rights grounds. She's essentially arguing that she's being deprived of the right to be with her family. Aside from the language issue, her husband meets all the other requirements to qualify for a visa. Mian Mayat is a local politician from Leicester, the city where Chapti lives. He says Chapti's husband can't reasonably be expected to take English lessons before he arrives in Britain. For one thing, he
he lives in a remote village where no one speaks English.
He would have to travel something like 180 miles just to take these lessons. These lessons, which we would need to pass this test, would be something like 40 to 50 lessons.
Which, Myatt says, would cost something like 15 times the man's annual salary. Myatt says family reunification is at stake. That's a principle that's been enshrined in British and US immigration law for decades. But under the new rule, Rashida Chapti and her husband don't qualify for it.
She is a full naturalized British citizen. She has every right to be here in this country. And thus, her husband, Mr. Chapti, should have immediate and exclusive right to be here in this country.
Well, of course, one feels sympathy for the Chapti family, but I think the government policy is right.
This is Dominic Rubb, a Member of Parliament for the ruling Conservatives.
Unless you're fleeing persecution, coming to Britain is a privilege, not a right, and it carries certain responsibilities. And one of those is to learn enough English to get by in the community. It's better for newcomers, but it's also better for our society because it encourages integration rather than segregation.
Rubb is especially annoyed that Chapti's lawyers have invoked the European Convention on Human Rights. Many British politicians resent European laws that supersede their own. But in rejecting multiculturalism, the British government's rhetoric is actually in line with many on the European mainland, notably Germany. German Chancellor Angela Merkel has declared that multiculturalism doesn't work and that everyone there should learn German. For The World, I'm Patrick Cox.
Actually, Merkel went further than that. She said that multiculturalism had, quote, utterly failed. Right now, Europe seems to be headed for some kind of period of retrenchment, at least in terms of its nation states, national identities, and that of course includes languages. Well, back to Britain now, and no question, good idea to learn the language. It is the globe's most useful, and certainly the most useful in Britain. And as part of that, you will inevitably learn the swear words. Well, some people of course only learn the swear words in a foreign language. We've all done a bit of that, right? Well, many of us. And there are some very good websites out there that service that very need. Well, learning those naughty, naughty words is one thing. Using them in public is another. For a few weeks now, the British town of Barnsley has been fining people for swearing in public. Here's The Big Show's London-based correspondent, Laura Lynch.
It's not as if the people of Barnsley are cursing a blue streak all day, every day. But some of the townsfolk agreed with the police that Barnsley could use a little more gentility, a little more politesse. So the posters went up, the word went out. Abusive, aggressive swearing won't be tolerated, and the punishment could be a $130 fine. At least some residents expect police to collect lots of fines for uttering four-letter words.
I think there'll be a lot of fines. I really do. I hope they're not around here.
Well, I think when you've got children or grandchildren with you, it's not very nice.
Seems a bit of a waste of police time, doesn't it?
Barnsley is no trendsetter when it comes to barnstorming against bad words. Other cities, countries, even some American states have tried to outlaw cussing and cursing in public. On the opposite end, though, are places like Hyde Park in London. More specifically, Speaker's Corner.
All the Middle East is boiling now with the rejection for our regime submitting to the will of the West. We do not want that anymore, and we are not accepting it.
Egyptian student Miriam is on her soapbox, in this case an upturned plastic crate, exercising her right to free speech in a place where swearing in public is pretty much tolerated. Not for Miriam, though. She supports Barnsley's efforts.
It's good to have a high morality standard in the society. People should not be allowed to disturb the other people's lives.
A veteran of Speaker's Corner, Heiko Koo, disagrees.
Barnsley is a famous mining town, so it was a very proletarian zone, people living down the mines for centuries and living off that type of existence. So the idea that you can make it posh and polite is an absurdity.
For some in Barnsley, though, putting a stop to swearing in public is really about the bottom line. That's why greengrocer Mitch Millward supports the campaign.
People don't want to hear that kind of thing as they're going around doing the general shopping, and, you know, every little bit helps. If it helps more people into town, into the market, we're all for it.
And so, if I can say this, vulgarity be damned in Barnsley. Can I say that?
Well, you did, Laura. You just did. I won't tell anyone. Okay, moving swiftly on now to Anchorage, Alaska, a curse-free zone. no doubt. Well, even in the summertime, Alaska seems about as far away as you can get from South Sudan. But guess what? More and more refugees from Sudan and what is now South Sudan are making a home in Anchorage. And now they come up with a way to keep their American-born children connected to the homeland. Language classes. Annie Feit of the Alaska Public Radio Network has the story from Anchorage.
In a small classroom in a Baptist church, Madine Bowl asks for volunteers to read a short passage in Nuer, his native language. Three kids up front leap out of their chairs to get Bowl's attention. But he calls on a quieter student sitting in the back.
You will be next, okay?
It's a short story about a man and a woman who milk a cow, and it paints a picture of a life these kids have never known. They were born in the United States, most of them in Omaha, Nebraska. Their parents were resettled there in the 90s after fleeing civil war in Sudan and enduring 10 to 15 years in refugee camps in Africa. Madine Bowl has seven children, all born in the U.S. He says his 12-year-old daughter, Nagua, is typical of all his kids.
You know, when she was 2, 3, 4 years old, she speak very good Nuer. When she went to school, she lost it all. And now, you know, I cannot communicate with her well in Nuer. She forced me to go and speak in English.
It's a common story among the Sudanese in Anchorage. So last summer, Bowl and other leaders in the Sudanese community decided to start the language classes. Daniel Gottkot is another teacher here. He has six daughters, and they all have trouble communicating with his wife.
Example, my wife, she doesn't speak good English. How can a parent live with the children and their children don't understand their parent?
There are now about 1,000 refugees from South Sudan living in Anchorage. Gottkot arrived in the city in 2008. Like many Sudanese here, he left Nebraska when the economy went sour, hoping to find work in the oil fields on Alaska's North Slope.
That's why we moved over here. Some of people, they want to work at North Slope.
The oil companies weren't hiring, so Gottkot found a good job with the Anchorage School District as a language and cultural liaison. But Gottkot's real passion is teaching Nuer three nights a week. On this night, there are about 30 students divided among three classrooms. The oldest kids sit at long tables in a bright room at the front of the church. They repeat phrases their teacher calls out. Fifth grader Teach Wall was born in New York a few months after her family arrived in the U.S.
I would have been born in Africa if we just like stayed there for like another 3 or 4 months.
Teach says the classes are helping her communicate better with her mom.
Well, when I talk, like I talk in Nuer and English mixed up. Like if I were to say a word, I would say, and then after I like to say a sentence in Nuer, I'd put a little bit of English in it.
The classes are also helping Teach feel connected to the place her parents are from. She's writing a report on South Sudan for her elementary school class. She says she's seen videos from the country, but can't quite picture what it looks like. She does know one thing, though. It's hot in Sudan. And that's a big contrast to her home here.
I don't like snow because it's cold and freezing.
A lot of the kids and adults at the language class feel this way. The younger students waste no time bringing the subject up when I ask them if they like living in Anchorage.
It's too snowy.
Yeah, it's too windy. I mean, too rainy.
And it's too cold.
So how come you don't like the snow? I thought all kids like the snow.
No, because snow's too cold. It gets in your shoes. And it gets
I like snow because when snow's not dirty, I eat it.
Even with their complaints about the climate, none of the Sudanese families has any plans to go back to their newly independent homeland. They say it's still too unstable. Madine Bowl says he'd like to return someday with his seven children. In the meantime, though, he says he's focused on building a strong Sudanese community in Anchorage. For The World, I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
Okay, well, from Alaska to Zambia, and of course in some of the more well-known parts of the Muslim world, Ramadan has begun. And each year during Ramadan, more than 100 kids from across the Islamic world head to Cairo to take part in something called the International Holy Quran Competition. This contest is a big deal. The top contestants become, well, they become stars. You can think of it as something like a national spelling bee, or an international spelling bee, really. But instead of memorizing words, these kids have memorized the Quran. Yep, the whole thing. And now there's a documentary about it. It's called Quran by Heart. If you have HBO, you can see it on demand or HBO Go. The film follows 3 10-year-olds. There's a boy from Tajikistan, another boy who's from Senegal, and a girl from the Maldives. They all took part in last year's contest. We're going to hear a little bit right now from each of them, reciting from the Quran. And then after that, you're going to hear the Big Show's Lisa Marlins talking with Quran by Heart director Greg Barker.
So that's the sound of the best and brightest young kids from across the Islamic world come together to see who can recite the Quran most accurately and most beautifully. There's an enormous amount of importance placed on the artistry of recitation. And what's amazing is to hear these 10-year-old kids who have this book in their heads and can command a single passage sort of as they're prompted by the judges, but also they bring to it their own individual expression, their own artistry. And that was really what captivated me as a storyteller. And ultimately, we use the stories of these amazing 10-year-old kids as a window into the next generation of Muslims around the world.
And some of the kids are 10. These are among the youngest. There was a 7-year-old, in fact, as well. And as you say, the artistry is a major part of this. They're reciting the Quran. They're almost singing it. And is that their own individual expression? Are they finding the rhythm and even the melody in these cases?
They are. Quranic recitation has very, very precise rules of pronunciation. And, of course, the text has to be exact. But the individual reciter has freedom over how they actually recite it, the melody. Now, to Muslims, they do not consider it music. But it's interesting because non-Muslim scholars who study it all tend to be musicologists. Hmm. I mean, to the non-Muslim ear, it sounds like music. And the melody is completely improvised, sort of inspired by the moment.
Oh, you mean if one of these competitors does it twice, they might do it 2 different ways?
Yes.
Wow. There's so much that's
amazing.
It's really amazing. It's, you know, the idea that these kids are memorizing a text that's like 600 pages long, correct?
Yeah, 600 pages long, you know, thousands of verses. It's really extraordinary.
Why do they do it? And this one that you're focusing on is in Cairo. We know that there are others. There's one in Dubai, one in Tehran. But why are they memorizing the entire Quran?
Lots of Muslims memorize passages from the Quran. But not everybody, of course, memorizes the entire book. But it's just prized as a sign of knowledge, as a sign of someone who's a dedicated Muslim. So in the past 20 or 30 years or so, these contests have become incredibly popular across the Islamic world. And, of course, in the film, the question is, well, how do these young kids balance their religious education with their secular education?
Can you tell us exactly what happened in this big room? I mean, there were finalists who were named. The 3 kids that you were following, tell us more about them, the trek that they had made to get to this room at the time.
There's a boy from Senegal, a boy from the middle of nowhere, really, in Tajikistan, a young girl from the Maldives and the Indian Oceans, and they travel thousands of miles. It's really the adventure of a lifetime for them. It's like a national spelling bee, except it's more of like an Olympics-type competition for these kids because they really are there representing their countries.
And they probably have never been outside their countries. And in the case of Jamil, the little boy from Senegal, he's even said, you are representing not just your country, but your continent. And you see this adorable little kid who doesn't even have anybody accompanying him to Cairo.
Yeah, there's a lot of pressure on these kids. And the kids themselves are just so endearing. And the reason that we focused on some of the youngest competitors is they're kind of on the cusp of entering the discussion about the future of Islam, which kind of is swirling around them. But they themselves are sort of still innocent. And I think the question that we're all left with is, what does the future hold? And through them, we kind of get a sense of where Islam itself is headed over the next 10, 20 years.
Now, that's the kind of the subtext of the competition. How did you encounter that? Maybe even in the families of these kids.
These families let us into those discussions. So this young girl, Rifta, from the Maldives, is very, very bright, straight-A student. Her mother wants her to be a scientist. and to have a career. Her father, as it turns out, had some kind of religious experience 10 years ago and has become increasingly fundamentalist in his viewpoints and actually wants her to not have a career but just stay at home and be a housewife.
I'd like you to tell us a little bit more about Nabiola, because you really got into that family as well. This is the 10-year-old from Tajikistan. He has gone to a school that has specifically taught him the recitation of the Quran. But then the school closed. The government was worried about extremist teachings. There's one scene, and this boy just amazes everybody with his recitation. But there's one scene where his dad takes him to apply to a different school, a better school, and something happens. I wonder if you can describe it for us.
Yes. I mean, he's taken to this government-sponsored school in the capital of Tajikistan, Dushanbe. And as he's quizzed by the principal there, it emerges that Nabiola is essentially illiterate in his own language, Tajik, can't really read or write. And this is because his studies up until that point have been exclusively focused on the Quran. And I think Nabiola's father is a bit astonished by this, because he thought he was sending his boy to one of the best religious schools. Of course, in Cairo, in the competition, Nabiola is the superstar.
Yeah, so that brings us back to the competition itself. I want to play a little clip of him in the recitation there. This little kid is in front of the computer that's giving him the prompts, where to begin a verse and which part he should end on. His head is like table level. I mean, he can barely look above the table.
That's right, and his feet don't touch the floor. He's a small little kid, and he's given a single prompt for the first passage in a chapter in the Quran and the end line. And then he has to fill in the blanks. And it could be like a 3 or 4 minute passage. He has to just recall instantly. And he just goes into this other place. He closes his eyes. And as he says in the film, he actually sees the pages of the Quran in front of him. And although he doesn't read Arabic, he knows kind of what these symbols represent. And he just starts, and he has the most beautiful, melodic, entrancing, is that the right word? It must be a sort of compelling voice. And there's this amazing moment near the end where he's asked to recite for the president of Egypt, who at the time is Mubarak, because we filmed this last August. And he says, you know, wow, I didn't really know that this was such a big deal. Presidents don't come to listen to anybody. They only come out for big things. And it's this wonderful sort of moment of innocence that just reminds the audience that this is just a 10-year-old kid.
Greg Barker is the filmmaker of the new documentary Quran by Heart. It's a beautiful film, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Listening to that reminded me of the first time I met a kid who was learning the Quran. It really blew me away. It was in Bangladesh at a madrasa, religious school in the countryside. And this one boy who talked to me about it, he was older than 10. He was maybe 12 or 13. He had most of it memorized, he said. And of course, I asked him to recite some of it. And you know, once he started, it was really difficult to get him to stop. But it was also really entrancing to listen to. I didn't want to stop listening to it. I'll post some photos that I took of him and some of the other kids and their teachers. I'll post them at all the usual places, patrickcox.wordpress.com and theworld.org/language. And see you next week for more podding.